Well, it's about 18 degrees in St. Louis. Snowing now. The entrance to the cave is nearly impassable. My engineers in Los Angeles are whining because it's 49 degrees. They said it's cold. Come on, guys, get tough. Back in a moment. I love this. Kurt Fast Blast Me from Milwaukee said, George, it's 3 degrees here. Quit whining. I love it. Back with our guest, Paul Pearsall. Paul, tell us about this doctor that made a call to you. You're going to tell us an incredible story.
Absolutely. Just want to point out it's 74 degrees here in Hawaii. I'm not whining.
No, I don't think you are.
The story, it's still shocking when I collect these, but we've now got 75 of these cases. And this one I didn't even record because it's only by phone. A nurse had called up to say, you've got to talk to this doctor. He's reluctant to do it because he doesn't, quote, buy this stuff. And that happens to me a lot in this research, that people want to almost do it as a confessional and then not stand behind their report. But this doctor got a new heart, and he can't sleep. He's having redundant nightmares, throbbing headache in the back of his head, and for some reason, he's smelling alcohol. And when there's no alcohol in his room, we're very careful about that. So can you talk to him? So I finally talked to the guy, and he begins by saying this. Look, I don't believe any of this crap, and that's not exactly the word he used. But I've got to talk to somebody. Ever since I got this GD new heart, very angry, he said, I can't sleep. I dream the same dream every night at the same time and wake up. And the dream is this. I am rolling down 3 flights of narrow wood stairs and bang my head on the bottom of the floor, at the bottom of the stair, and die. And I'm a woman. I need to know who my donor is. Well, this is not easy to do. So I said, I'll look into it for you if I can. And I can't talk about where this is for confidentiality reasons. But through all of the efforts we did with this nurse, we're able to track the donor without getting the name. The donor was a college co-ed who was at a kegger, a beer party, with a fraternity and a sorority. And everybody else went out to eat. And she had gotten drunk and fallen asleep upstairs on the 3rd floor. People forgot her. When she woke up, she fell 3 flights of stairs, banged her head on the bottom, and died.
Oh.
And that was his exact dream. Now, we can explain that in many, many ways. But when you have this many cases, it's very important, just because they're cases and reports, that we look at them. And in my research, what we did is make sure we interviewed the donor families, as many donor physician medical teams as we could, recipient medical teams, recipient nurses, recipient families, and the recipient. And then, by the way, Dr. Schwartz was one of the researchers with us on one of the studies, Gary Schwartz. We had gone through and then correlated to see how many of the words, how many of the examples and the stories and the scenes correlated with the donor. And we had far above statistical chance correlation between recipient report and donor lifestyle. And that story is just one example of many that shows what we talked about all show tonight. We are connected on levels we have yet to imagine. And until we realize that and stop focusing on self-help and how I can be and me, and start looking at how profoundly we're connected, we'll never fully understand the gift of this life.
Let me tell you how you've connected with Brett from Baja California, who was writing in about that story you told us before the break about the little boy and the mother wanted to hear the heart of her son. And he starts it by saying, the story about may I listen to my son's heart in your chest. Hearing that has done a lot more than just tear me up. I'm still crying. It's an image that will stay with me for the rest of my life. And he's right.
It positively haunts me, and we could spend another 4 hours tonight telling stories that are like that. The little girl who got the heart of another little girl. and she referred to her as the angel in her chest, and how she would cry for this lost little girl who couldn't seem to find her way, and kept talking about that little girl. She could even guess the name of that little girl. And until she was able to embrace that and realize that that little girl's going to be part of her, she couldn't rest. And finally, when she said, I'm just going to talk to her, even though she's not here, and tell her she's welcome in me and she's part of me. So, and probably the most dramatic story from a research point of view for me was reported in the Detroit Free Press years ago, when a very skeptical reporter who had criticized my research on this said, I'm going to follow a little boy through this procedure. So a little two-year-old got a new heart. And he's watching the procedure, going through this whole thing. The reporter's recording it all, just a mechanical thing here, he thought. And then something startling happened. The little two-year-old boy, lying in his little crib bed there after the heart transplant, begins to execute perfect ballet movements with his legs.
As a little two-year-old?
The little two-year-old. And the donor, of course, was a little ballerina.
Yeah.
And the reporter wrote in the newspaper, who in the heck's heart is this? Whose body is this? Whose soul is this? This is a reporter. So this raises questions, and as happens on your show a lot, I'm sure, many people are bothered by the idea that this stuff just pushes the envelope. But we are connected profoundly, profoundly, far above just the simplistic models that we see presented today.
Let's go to the phones. Let's take some calls. You ready, Paul?
Oh, sure.
East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, I'm Helen, and I'm calling from Rapid City, South Dakota, where it's equally as cold.
Sure it is.
Yeah, I just got through reading Partners of the Heart. It was a story about the cardiologist Dr. Walter Lehigh, kind of a maverick. I got into a portion of the story where they had done the first VSD, ventricle septal defect, for those of you who don't know it. It's a hole between the two lower chambers of the heart, and they'd never done that before. They did it on a little four-year-old from Ontario, Canada, on May 15, 1955. Unfortunately, he died from complications. 5 years later to the date, I had the same surgery at 16, and I sat there and I weeped and I weeped and I weeped because I had no idea about this little boy until I read it in this, in the story. So I had an awfully experience from this when I read this last week. So I consider myself truly lucky.
Absolutely, and you just identified what we meant by that awe response, something that took you far beyond just yourself to what all this means, and something that changed what we psychologists call your own cognitive map, the way you'll explain things. It really changes how you look at life.
Well, I tried to get a hold of the parents in this town, but evidently they don't live there anymore because I wanted to thank them, because if it hadn't been for little Jimmy, I probably wouldn't be here.
Well, you know, and the difficulty when we're doing a lot of this research is I'd say half of my patients, actually in the research project, were made fun of and asked me never again to use their names before they let me use the names.
Mm-hmm.
When the morning show once came to interview some of these patients, and were so skeptical that they made them feel so uncomfortable. One woman who got a new heart was fired for talking about this because they thought her to be psychiatrically disturbed. So the problem with this is patients who, when you're talking about this yourself, many of the patients I interview say, I don't want to tell anybody, because the next thing you know, they're going to send in the psychiatrist and they're going to start medicating me. And they're afraid to speak of this phenomenon of how profoundly we can be influenced by other people's lives.
Exactly, exactly. Well, thank you for being on this evening. I've learned so much.
Well, thank you for calling.
Yeah.
Thanks, Helen. I appreciate you being on the program. You know, Gary Schwartz came into some fire from Alison Dubois, who's on the television show Medium, who her life is depicted in that. And, you know, she didn't want him to, I guess, talk about the research that he had conducted. And that was unfortunate because, I mean, she has well publicized her own career and her own life. In, you know, what the Dr. Schwartz is merely trying to do, Paul, is to let the world know how real this stuff is.
Well, if you talk to, well, you do talk to Gary, but if you talk to good researchers like Gary Schwartz, he doesn't have any answers. He's saying, I'm studying this.
Yes.
I'm looking at this. But we want to shoot the messenger. And that's why when people ask me, why did you write the last self-help book I said, because I want to make sure people understand there's more here. Isn't that how we started the whole show? But people like Gary, like Ian Stevenson, like John Mackey, and myself, and maybe hundreds of others who dare to challenge this, who present stories like this, and say, can you think about them? What do they mean? What do these really mean? And then we get a lot of flack and a lot of hostility. We began the show talking about the guy in France who did the face transplant. Now they're beating him up. Anybody who starts to stretch that envelope better be ready to stand some heat.
You're right. International line, where are you calling from? You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Dave. I'm calling from Canada.
Hi, David.
Hi, good morning, Dr. Pearsall.
Good morning. Thanks for calling.
Great show, Dave. Just special. I did want to ask you one or two questions, Doctor, that I was a little, I don't know, uncomfortable with or something, or maybe at odds with, and it's kind of simplistic, and then one statement about the people that call this show. One was when you said, if I caught you right, Doctor, you said maybe don't let the anger explode, don't let it out, just shut up and sit down kind of thing, if I read you right.
Correct.
Well, I feel that many times that I've let my anger out to people I love, they've heard me, and then when I walk into my room, my heart stops beating at 100 times a minute, but when they won't hear me, my heart is beating for a half hour, I'm self-hating, I'm uncertain. So right on that one point, I feel that there is times, depending on who you're dealing with, where you should really be able to let out the anger, as long as you're really around people you love and you're not going to punch each other or anything like that. So on that point of don't let it out, just hold it in and get past it, sometimes you have to let it out, and then you can go into your room and really feel loved, that they cared enough to hear you out, your anger, your pain, and then you can go be quiet. That was just one observation.
Can I comment on that before you get to the other?
Certainly.
That's an excellent point, because we hear that a lot. And let me just describe what happens when you express your anger to you and the person to whom you express it.
Right.
When you express your anger, immediately the platelets, those little blood cells in your body, get sticky and start to stick in the arteries. The ventricle in your heart begins to quiver. The heart muscle shakes and becomes hard. As I said, one out of five sudden deaths from myocardial infarction happen with the expression of anger. Your immune system reduces its effectiveness. Cortisol spurts throughout your body. Your pupils dilate. Your stomach constricts. The bladder constricts. The body is in horrendous shape. The person who feels that anger has a similar response. So it doesn't really vent it out. Even though you think, well, look, I did it to somebody I love, at least I was heard. The idea is to express that feeling after you've calmed down. But the hardest thing to convince people about is that it will dissipate, because Freud and these other people had, and self-help books say, if you don't vent it, it will build up. I can only tell you as a scientist that the best treatment for this, for anger, is to sit down, and I know it's going to sound like that old cliche, and do two things. Let it pass. You want to count to 50 or whatever, but there is a technique that stops it. It's a specific research technique, and what it is to take your tongue and put it by that bony protuberance in the mouth, just behind your teeth. You can even do it while I'm talking to you now, and you then breathe in through your nose and counting to four. And then you hold your breath for a count of seven, and then out through your mouth, with a whoosh, and count to eight slowly. Just two or three of those breaths, and the cortisol reduces, the heart relaxes, and then you can express the feeling that was the anger, but it doesn't come out in this hot, rageful anger expression that really is a deadly emotion. But it's a hard thing to convince people of, because we've all been taught, I'll feel better. And if you believe it and think it, sometimes you think you are when you leave that room and think, there, I got it out, and we're done. It just is not a good thing to do based on the data.
Well, I certainly wouldn't argue with you medically, and I'll try that, because it could only help trying different things. The second question, and that was a very interesting answer. The second question was, when you mentioned the Hawaiian situation and the surrounding of the bed and so forth, did you mean anything was happening more than mystical, more than in any special way, more than the spiritual other things that you had mentioned? Was anything more going on with the Hawaiians than you find in that spiritual connection of healing that you were talking about? Then one last statement.
Yeah, there was more. There was so much going on in that room that it makes me cry even to think about it because she was so dear to me. But what would happen, I looked at the heart monitor, if you're ready for this one. We would notice that she was struggling for life. But when our heart beats, because I had my finger on the pulse of this person, and I was holding the hand of someone else next to her, loved her, and I could feel my own pulse, our pulses would fall into sync with hers and slow her heart down. Because there seemed to be this panic that you would imagine when you're facing your death, even if you're not conscious. And it seemed to slow things down. So yes, is my answer to your question. There were some actual medical, tangible evidence in that room that the hearts in that room were falling into sync, making this passing a little easier for that person. That may sound strange, but it, in addition to the spiritual support, the loving aloha that Hawaiians call it that was on that room, something medical happened that allowed this person to see some of that struggling and finally pass with a lot more peace.
That's very special. One last statement, if you don't mind.
Sure.
The people, when you mentioned earlier, who called this station and are maybe intrinsically seem to be happier than the next guy, per se, when you mentioned that, when even George, I think, was in on that moment. The reason I think that takes place is we are people who are given to, number one, creative thinking.
Right.
Number two, we are willing to listen. We are seekers, so we're not so tangibly inclined generally. And maybe through that, through wanting to listen, through wanting to be creative thinkers and so forth, we are by that very fact not going to look at Book 7, Anthem 1, and find the answer to, there it is. And one other thought is maybe if we can get comfortable in our own skin, maybe there's a big answer there, too.
I think you're right. I think that the listeners that call in have no answers. They're still looking. And that's what makes for a smart, wise, spiritual person who has an open heart and an open mind.
Paul, would you give us your website? Spell it for us, please.
It's www.paul, P-A-U-L, Pearsall, P-E-A-R-S-A-L-L. .com.
And this new book, the last self-help book you'll ever need, is available there?
Yep.
And bookstores as well?
Sure, I certainly hope so for my sake.
That's right. You're in Hawaii. You don't know what's going on over here.
I have not got a clue. I'm just enjoying this place and this culture that seems to... It's really strange. When I present the idea, my ideas and the ideas on your show to the Hawaiians here that really know the Hawaiian culture, they'll say, so what's new about that? We've been thinking about that for 2,000 years.
Stay with us. We'll be back with final phone calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Paul Pearsall. Well, we got a series of fantastic programs for you in store this week on Coast to Coast. Hey, by the way, if you aren't a member yet of the Filament Book Club, take advantage if you want to get one of those free electronic books. They just want you to be a member of their book club. Want the information? We'll go to the homepage on coasttocoastam.com. Go right down to the bottom. There's the Filament Book Club link. Or go to www.filament, F-I-L-A-M-E-N-T, filamentbookclub.com. Hey, Paul, you might want to repeat that anger venting technique that you just mentioned because I'm getting hundreds of messages for it.
Okay, it's very important, again, that you understand that one of the things that really goes wrong when you express your anger is your breathing gets all upset as part of this anger expression. When you settle that breath, you've heard the phrase, catch your breath, it stops the cortisol release. It really settles down the heart, and the technique goes this way. Sit down if you can. Can't, you can do it standing up, but sit down, lower your shoulders, place your tongue against that bony part just behind your teeth, if you know what I mean. By the way, if you ever have those ice headaches, you ever know when you have something they call it a frozen brain where you get that headache?
I hate that.
Yeah, you know how to stop it right away? You just take your tongue and tap it against that bony protuberance, and that'll make the headache go away.
I did not know that.
So that's a little technique we gave him tonight, George, that'll change your life forever.
I love it. And let's go back to the phones. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Marcella. I'm calling from Oregon.
Hi, Marcella.
What a lovely program you're having tonight.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for talking to us, Dr. Pearsall. I knew that you and I were on the same page.
Oh, thank you.
When you quoted the Eagles song, Get Over It.
Oh, yes.
I that's an anthem for me. I just love it.
I love it. You notice I cleaned it up a lot from what they said in the song.
You very much did, and I'm sure that George appreciates that.
Yeah.
There are a couple things I wanted to talk about. The first one would be that I have fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue, and I've been disabled for 5 years because of it.
Wow.
And one of the first things I did when I first got it was to go on the internet and find other people like me who are, you know, we're all looking for something that will help us with our symptoms because
right.
Nobody knows what it is yet. And so there's no cure. There's no magic bullet. So I was in contact with a lot of these people who have fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue. A few years ago when Oprah Winfrey and her program producers decided to do a program on fibromyalgia. So they put the word out amongst our groups that, you know, we should write in with our experiences. And we all thought, oh, fabulous, we've hit the jackpot. You know, we're going to get some airtime for this very strange and baffling disease. Well, it turns out that what they were looking for were people who would come on Oprah and say, I'm sick because my mind is making me sick.
Right.
And it's all my fault, and it's all in my head, and if I can only change my mind, then I'm sure I will feel better. And, of course, this is a burden that we bear every day because our doctors and our teachers and our family and friends look at us sometimes and say, you're just malingering. It's all in your head. Just get up. I can't believe that you hurt all the time. I can't believe that you're tired all the time. It's all in your head. Just move along, you know. So we fight this battle every day. And as far as I know, Oprah has not had a show on fibromyalgia because I don't think she could find anyone who actually has the disease who would actually come out and say something like that.
Well, that's you have your finger right on the pulse of what I talked about this last self-help book. The whole self-help movement is based on the idea that if you only thought the right way, you wouldn't be like you are. And somehow you brought this on by the wrong thinking. That's just in the medical condition you're describing, it's baloney. The research just doesn't support it. If it was that simple, all I'd have to tell you on the phone right now is, well, why don't you just think more happily and these symptoms will go away. Next caller. It isn't that easy, but that's what happens in the self-help movement. So I really empathize with that. I think that's why Oprah Magazine refused to run a review on my book, because I wouldn't say that. I just know it's more complex than that. And the research in the field is, as you know, just beginning where they're taking this seriously, looking at it as a condition that has to be researched from many angles, including, by the way, the immune system, to see how the immune system's functioning, what stressors are on that immune system. But it's very difficult if you're going to just make this an issue of just change your mind and the situation will go away and will motivate you out of it. It's just really angering to people who suffer.
Let's go to our wild card line. It's your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Oh, okay, I didn't know if I was on or not. I'm Tom. I'm calling from Roswell, New Mexico.
Now, that would be a fitting place to call from on this program.
Yeah, I guess it would be. Anyway, after listening to your guest there, I kind of agree with him on what he's saying about the, you know, loving yourself. The thing is that it's not so much that, you know, it's wrong to love yourself. It's just the kind of love that you're giving to yourself. Most people, you know, it's like buy a new car, go out and get plastic surgery. Like you said, bonds of steel. And that's narcissism, and it's abuse. It's not love. You know, you're not really taking care of yourself. And to me, you know, if you're going to love yourself, you have to love yourself the way that a parent loves a child, you know. And what you do for yourself is for the good of yourself. And that's what you want to teach yourself, and that's what you want to give to somebody else. Because in the end, that's what you're trying to do, is love yourself so you can love others.
But the premise of the research, again, is I understand exactly what you're saying. You raise a good point. You're saying that you certainly don't want to be thinking, I'm a rat, I'm no good, I'm a negative person. But the idea is that what's going on in your head, and if what's in your head is about other people, it translates immediately. I'm telling you now as a psychoneuroimmunologist, your beliefs become your biology. Hear that phrase again, please. Your beliefs become your biology. And the healthiest thoughts we have are not about the self. Even if we talk about self-love, if you learn to love others, then you start to have this great kind of altruistic spurt that comes into you. So our view, and by the way, a lot of ancient cultures, including the Hawaiian, believe in the idea that self-regard is much less important as a starting point than us-regard, and looking outward rather than inward. I know that's a controversial approach, because we're taught that you can't even love somebody else unless you first love yourself. But I only offer to you the suggestion that what if that was reversed? And that's what I did in the book. I reversed all the advice and said, what if you tried the other way too? What if you thought, I'm going to think, remember that little test I said in the show about not counting up the number of I, me, you that you think, the words you use in that ratio. If you start thinking more about others, more about connection, more we, us, than I, me, the translation to your immune system is profound and immediate, and that's a key point.
Well, that's an interesting concept. I still believe before you can do that, though, before you can, you know, even recognize the beauty in a flower or anything else, you have to be able to recognize it in yourself. You can't give, you know, it goes back to the old argument, you can't give what you don't have. You know, that's like if somebody walked up to you and said, I need you to loan me $5,000. If you got $5 in your pocket, you can't lend a person $5,000. You know, and even if you wanted to, you know, and I do agree with you that it's about everybody else. It's not about yourself, you know, but in order to help other people, you have to be able to help yourself. You know, it's like if I'm a bum on a street, I can't help somebody else down the street.
Right. You know? And I understand that's an excellent point. You're saying, look, if I'm weak and frail and broken, how am I going to be able to be of any help to other people? But we're talking about the basic consciousness here. And as I said, the question that we ask, and that's the choice you have to make. Many of the self-help programs are asked this question. Is your life a joy? Are you leading the maximum life? There's books by that title. Our question was, remember, think of the person who knows you the best. And would they say that you're a true joy to live with every day? If you answer that question yes, then the feeling about self tends to be a very strong, good, loving concept. And that's a good question to keep in mind to sort of change that focus.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, it's your turn.
Thank you. I would first like to say thank you, gentlemen, for taking my call. Okay, you have made me think of many topics. Okay, the first topic I'd like to speak of is truly about the anger. I was in a car accident, and a boy stole his dad's car, hit my car with all the kids, and I'm the one who woke up the next day paralyzed from the neck down.
Oh, my.
But yet, prayed to God, you know, I mean, because there was nobody home to help me out. I prayed to God, and I don't know how long the time went, if it was 2 hours, if it was 20 minutes, I really don't remember, but I began to move again. And I remember, you know, just praying and praying, and my ears were filled with tears, and I was like, okay, God, if this is how it's going to be, this is how it's going to be, I'll do the best I can. And when I finished that, I began to move. And another thing, I had cancer. I had cancer for 9 years, and I had to deal with that. And when I finally said, you know what, I'm tired of fighting, then all of a sudden I started getting well again.
You're a testimony to what we researched in the last self-help book, because that's exactly the point. Let's go back to your first point. Had you reacted with legitimate anger, you have every right to be angry, really, to have somebody do this to your life, but anger would have only crippled you more. And when you didn't do that, you came alive again. Secondly, the research shows, isn't this surprising, when we compared lottery winners with persons who were suddenly rendered crippled from the neck down by some type of trauma, who was the happiest group after a year? It was those who were crippled by an accident.
True.
Why is that? They became more alive, much less selfish, much more appreciative of life. People like you and I, who've really known this suffering, where you can't move and the agony and the pain, know what it's like to really be alive. And that's why I hope that you'll embrace this statement. Our greatest strengths are forged in the crucible of adversity.
Yes.
I really believe that.
Yes. Those were like the two big events in my life. And when I had first had gotten the word that I had cancer, what was running through my mind, because I had three small children, was, okay, well, I don't know how long I'm going to be here, so I have to teach them as much as I can.
Absolutely.
And people were almost in awe that my daughter, my youngest daughter, she could, when I was sick, and I would crawl from coming in the house and crawl on the floor, and I would be laying in a sleeping bag in the living room because I wanted to see my kids go to school. And I, my daughter, when my older daughter was sick, my youngest would make her soup in the microwave. She was only five.
Yep.
And she would take care of the older one because I couldn't do anything. And then not till a nurse came in and was helping everybody. But it was my kids, they're very well adjusted. They're very self-sufficient. And they help other people. And I said, you know what? I said, the biggest gift, because they ask me every Christmas, Mom, what do you want? And I said, you guys have to ask this after all these years.
George, I hope, again, if you were counting words, I didn't hear the word I in that description very much.
No, not from her.
Not from her, and that's what I mean. This is a person, what I mean, but it's not self-love, it's other love. This is a person whose life is invigorated by the fact of that selflessness, and I think it's just a profound example.
Wild card line, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us with Dr. Paul Pearsall. Hi there.
I'm Sam Kong from Arizona, and I was wondering, you were talking about how people that say I a lot or me a lot, they tend to be sick a lot and all that. Well, what about in my situation, I say we. When I talk about myself, a lot of times I use the term we or we're. Like if I'm going somewhere, we're going somewhere. It's not me or I'm going somewhere, it's we're.
Like, I see what you're meaning is you're actually still referring to yourself. You're just using we as a replacement for I. Is that what you're saying?
Right.
Yeah. So it probably, if you're really, that's still going to reflect on your health. In other words, it's really what you're meaning by this. It's a kind of a crude measure. But if you're really using it as a slang term for we and you really mean I, then that immune system's going to reflect it right away anyway.
So what you mean by we is others, not yourself.
You know, I think he's referring, George, to the fact that some people will say, well, we're going now, and he really means
he means himself. No, I know, but what you mean is he should be referring to other people whenever
he uses it. That's right. If he really meant me, a we, then he's going to get that translation. But if it's just a slang, sort of another word for I, he's not going to get the benefit of that collectiveness.
Now, sometimes I use we for me, but I'm a Gemini. There's two of me, so that qualifies.
There's a lot of you, George. I know that from all these years.
East of the Rockies, let's get you in on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello. This is Jess from Minneapolis.
Hi, Jess. Go ahead.
And I have a question for the guest. If he has found any relation of the donor organ memory phenomenon to cannibalistic practices such as eating flesh or drinking blood to gain, say, an enemy's strength or abilities.
Certainly in the cultural studies, there's been a lot of talks about that. Remember in the movie Dances with Wolves, when they would kill the buffalo, the Indians would eat the heart.
yes.
to get the energy of the animal. Of course, there's no research on that. So it probably would not have an effect in that sense other than what the belief system would be, because our data was, of course, looking at actual tissue implantation that really integrates with the system. But a lot of cultures still believe that somehow energy is still transferred, and that you see a lot of that in some mythologies and a lot of cultures.
Final call, west of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello?
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead there.
Oh, this is Sheila from San Diego.
Hello, Sheila.
Hello. I would love to talk to Dr. Pearsall, because I teach three classes in San Diego and three in L.A., and his book, The Heart's Code, is on my recommended reading list.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. And I talk about the chakras and the energy, and I talk about transplants. And I just wanted to run this by you. When the heart or the kidney or whatever the organ is donated, and the energy or the memories go with it. They go with it in the energy of the cell, right?
There's many explanations. The energy of the cell, some people think it's in the microtubules of the cell, some think it's a biochemical phenomenon, some think it's energy. The answer probably isn't either or, it's probably and. It's probably all those things.
You know, and I wish they'd do more research on that one, because that is a huge story.
It's a big deal, because it's the first evidence that we are connected, far more good scientific evidence. But we have to look at these microtubules. We have to look at this energy issue. We know that energy can't be created or destroyed, and so there is energy in those cells, and energy is forever. And that's, we really need to look at that in the data more carefully.
Paul, go enjoy your 74-degree weather.
I heard that resentment.
Take care. Get some sleep. Thanks a lot,
everything.
Paul.
Aloha.
Take care of yourself. PaulPearsall.com is his website. Wonderful person. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasore, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition, of course. Until then, be safe, everyone.